regarding the loans of Walters and Good, because Neil was virtually totally dependent for his income during this period of time on those two individuals' contributions to his company.
Now, it's my understanding that Silverado was in bad shape as early as 1987, with, I believe, one audit saying that it should actually be closed. What happened to delay a closure of Silverado?
Well, probably the thing that played the biggest role in its delay was, yes, they did know by 1987 that Silverado was in serious trouble. And certainly by 1988, they knew that this shop should have been closed, and there's plenty of regulatory documents that show that they were being warned by their frontline examiners that this shop was hemorrhaging red ink. But there was a little problem in 1988. We had an election coming up. Ronald Reagan was closing out his 8-year term, and George Bush was coming in behind him. And the last thing in the world George Bush needed during a campaign was to have his son wrapped up into a kind of mess, public relations mess, that we now see. So the Colorado Savings and Loan authorities, the state authorities, wanted to close Silverado in October of 1988. They were ready to do it. The Fed stepped in from Washington and stopped it and held off that takeover until after the election. And in fact, the closure order on Silverado was issued on Wednesday, November the 9th, 1988, one day after the presidential election.
Does this have any implications for others who've been involved in these kinds of SNLs?
Well, you know, it's symbolic, I guess, more than anything else. It's the government's way of saying we are going to handle these cases even-handedly, no matter who's involved. And I guess we'll all have to, when this all sorts out, and see whether, for example, Neil was also named in the $200 million lawsuit the government filed recently to reclaim some of the losses at Silverado. He's a defendant in that lawsuit. And if they lose the case, he will have his personal assets, theoretically anyway, attached to pay whatever the settlement ends up being. Of course, he's already begun preparing for this. He bought a $500,000 home recently in Denver and put it in his wife's name, not his name. When asked why he did that, his excuse was, "It was for estate purposes." But I suspect it was for legal purposes because he knows he has some liability here.
Stephen Pizzo is author of the book Inside Job, The Looting of America's Savings and Loans.
And I want to thank our engineer tonight, Anthony Sloan, and our editors and reporters, Julie Cohen, Jenny Bourne, 212-279-3400. Keep those phone calls coming in. Also thanks to Paul DiRienzo, 212-279-3400. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Don Rush in Washington for the WBAI Evening News.
And the following program you're about to hear on WBAI is rated NC-7. If you're a child under 7 years of age, turn on Nightline or something.
Someday, how do I get to town from here? And he said, well, just take a right where they're going to build that new shopping mall. Go straight past where they're going to put in the freeway. And take a left of what's going to be the new sports center. And keep going until you hit the place where they're thinking of building that drive-in.
Computers is a lab-wide utility. We manage the dozen mainframe computers, giant workforces for solving physics problems, together worth around, what, $6 million? The scientists using the computers were supposed to see a simple, powerful computing system, as reliable as the electric company. This meant keeping the machines running full-time, around the clock. And just like the electric company, we charged for every cycle of computing that was used. Out of 4,000 laboratory employees, maybe a quarter used the main computers. Each of these 1,000 accounts were tallied daily with the ledgers kept inside the computer.
And those are the sounds of Laurie Anderson after so many years. Back in 1982, that record came out. Big Science, her debut album. We heard From the Air and Big Science, and that frantic voice you heard in there towards the end was the voice of Clifford Stoll, reading from his book, The Cuckoo's Egg, which is a whole other story. And this is Emmanuel Goldstein. The program is The Fifth Corner, and we have a special expanded marathon edition tonight. And there's a purpose in mind with the special expanded marathon editions. The purpose is to raise money for this radio station, and we want to make that process as painless as possible for all of you out there. By showing your support for this radio station, you're enabling programs like this to continue, and programs that have not yet even been thought of to one day go on the air. It's a very important thing to have in New York City, and that's why we need your support at 212-279-3400 to make it easier for you and to make it appealing to the folks that like to listen to this radio program. We are offering subscriptions to the Hacker Quarterly 2600 magazine for every pledge of $55. That's just $10 above the regular BAI membership pledge. So if you give a call to 212-279-3400, you can take part in that offer. And for a pledge of $55, 2600 magazine will come faithfully to your home for the next year. It's as simple as that. So we don't want to spend too much time on this because we've got a lot of interesting things to talk about tonight. A couple of special guests are with us. We have to bring in 5 new members this hour. So if you're out there and you're not a member, we need you. We need you to become a member, and you can become a member by pledging any amount, really, but you'll get something back immediately by pledging a minimum of $45. And if you pledge $55, you will get $2,600, the Hacker Quarterly. Now, we also need volunteers to come in and staff our phones, and that's throughout the week coming up, day and night. So if you're interested in that, also give a call to that number. We have volunteers now in the tally room. Things aren't too busy down there. We have a caller on the line, but I like to see 2 or 3 phones ring, you know, because when you know there's people out there listening, you know, you feel inspired to move ahead and keep going. We have a lot to talk about tonight, folks. We're talking about computer hackers and the government, and the threats that are in the eyes of each of those from the others, and all that kind of thing. So we want to get started with that. We want to keep going. We have an expanded show tonight. We're going to 3:30 in the morning, but we do need to hear from you at 212-279-3400. And the beauty of this is that there's a limited number of people in the tally room. We have other people throughout the station. And when those phones start ringing, it means people from all throughout the station go running down to the tally room, and it might be the only time all night long that they see each other. But pleasantries are exchanged, and new people are met, and everyone's happy. So we have 3 lines ringing. That's great. That's really great to see. All those people can take advantage of the $2,600 offer. $55 pledge, you'll get 1 year of $2,600 magazine, the Hacker Quarterly, the only hacker magazine that dares to call itself a hacker magazine. More about that later. Again, the phone number 279-3400, 4 lines lit. Boy, I hope those are all pledges. I mean, that is incredible. If those are all pledges, I'm very, very happy. And by showing your support, boy, it sure makes me look good. I mean, imagine if I can get 5 new members like right away. Maybe I don't have to pitch anymore for the whole hour. Won't that be incredible? Well, we'll be in touch with the tally room, but are those phones ringing? Yes, there are phones ringing down there. 212-279-3400. Computer hackers in the news. You've noticed it more than ever before over the last several months or so. And one person that has been learning something, been covering that story, and sort of developing along with the stories, is a reporter from the Village Voice, who we have on the phone with us, Julian DiBella. You there?
Yes, I'm here, Manuel. Hi.
How you doing?
I'm all right.
Thanks for joining us tonight. And you are kind of new to the computer hacker world, is that right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm still, you know, outside of it, looking in rather than a part of it, and definitely new.
Uh huh. We also have with us from St. Louis, or close to St. Louis, actually, a person who has probably been the focal point of the entire hacker world this year, the publisher of FRAC newsletter, the electronic newsletter, who recently faced quite an ordeal, a trial where the government was attempting to prove that he was publishing proprietary information, something the whole hacker world, the whole computer world saw as a potential threat to civil liberties and freedom of speech and that kind of thing. On the phone with us is Craig Neidorf. Craig, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. We have quite a few things to ask you and to talk about between the both of you. Let me start with Julian and ask why you saw an interest in computer hacking. You first, I remember you started, was it last year?
Yeah, it started with a article I wrote for Spin magazine.
Uh-huh.
It was very introductory, and it goes back before that. When I started getting interested through other sort of subcultural realms, you know, through the cyberpunk fiction of William Gibson, and through a sort of techno-utopian post-hippie school out on the West Coast, you know, the whole Whole Earth catalog thing that has recently gotten into a much more technologically open perspective, seeing in new kinds of technology not as much of a threat as one used to in the bad old days of the 60s and things, but also the threat, but also you know, new possibilities for passion and for kinds of liberation and communication that weren't there before. And so, you know, my sense, in theory, having read, you know, these exciting science fiction books that talked about, you know, computers, and also, you know, read these West Coast people, was that, yeah, in theory, there are possibilities, but where is the practice? And when I got my first copy of 2600 magazine, I said, well, here it is. You know, these are people, you know, a kind of lived anarchy going on here, you know, in the best sense of the word, in relationship to the new technologies that are, you know, sort of growing up around us. And so, you know, and I had my own computer and a modem, and I had been sort of roaming around the world of bulletin boards, which anyone who's just, you know, sort of dived in head first knows that, you know, bulletin boards in general are pretty stuffy, can be pretty pedantic, stuffy places to hang out. And, you know, and here in the back of the 2600 were some numbers for some bulletin boards, and so I called one, and immediately I thought, whoa, this is a different scene, you know, this is, people were actually swearing online, you know, using curse words, and, you know, without fear of being kicked off by the sysops, and people were actually using handles, you know, and not their real names. It was just like a much more freewheeling sense of things.
That's kind of a microcosm, I guess. Hackers feel free to use four-letter words, so I guess that sort of says something about their attitude towards freedom of speech.
Right, exactly, and you know, increasingly, you know, given the cultural climate in this country, you know, it's becoming increasingly politically significant, pathetically enough, to, you know, to use that type of language. But that was just, you know, a vibe. There wasn't a lot of specific, you know, technical information being traded on this particular BBS, and because it was, you know, such an open board. And then, you know, eventually I saw a reference to another board that I could call, and this was a more quote-unquote clandestine board or more private board where, you know, when you call, you're greeted with a whole questionnaire that says, you know, explain what this acronym means, explain what, you know, are you a Fed, you know, whoever works for a public...
I think I know the board you're talking about, too. It's I guess what you would call it would be an elite bulletin board.
Right.
That's a hacker terminology.
Right. Although, you know, later after I wrote the piece and this came out, you know, I got a lot of hell for, you know, suggesting that this board I had called actually was elite, you know, that because... I would say, and I hesitate to criticize, you know, anything in the hacker world because there's so much criticism going on outside of it anyway. But there is a certain elitism within the hacker community, you know. So I thought, yeah, here's an elite board, but then, you know, I was later told, no, this isn't really elite. But it, you know, I was impressed when I first got on, basically by bluffing my way in, you know, looking through the pages of 2600 and saying, well, you know, this acronym must mean this and so forth.
Uh-huh. Well, since then you've written was it three pieces?
Please excuse interruption.
Uh-oh.
This is called 636-8595.
There's no, which, I don't know any Frank.
Thank you.
No Frank's here. Okay, someone's doing an emergency interrupt. That's real clever. But the only consolation there is that it cost them a pretty penny. I think emergency interrupts cost about $2 now. So anyway, you've gone on to write several articles for The Voice on hacking, each one seeming to get a little bit more intense. So what I'm wondering is, have you become kind of an expert on hacking?
Well, I'm no expert. I could never. I mean, the funny thing about, you know, as many hackers have pointed out, Eric Bloodaxe pointed out, you know, in a something he wrote for the net a while back,
Telecom Digest.
In Telecom Digest. You know, part of this, you know, thing that people can't handle about hackers is that these are teenagers and young adults who are experts beyond, you know, far beyond what, you know, older people have achieved. And I certainly would never claim, you know, around a hacker to be an expert in, you know, in the hacker world. But relative to other journalists, boy, you know, I would say that I have, you know, a better knowledge of what goes on. I mean,
well,
I called, just for instance, recently I talked to a guy with the police department here in Long Island who was involved in arresting a 14-year-old kid in Manhattan
and
a number of other...
His name is Delaney, right?
Delaney, yeah.
I forget what his first name is, but yeah, he's had quite a bit to say about hackers in the past few weeks.
Yeah.
And you spoke directly to him.
Yeah, and you know, I started asking him. Well, they had a list of people's names in the paper that had been arrested, and so I asked him, well, what are their handles? Can you give me their handles? And he, you know, paused for a second and said, you know, of all the journalists that have called me in the last few weeks, you're the first one that's ever asked, you know, what the handles are. You know, which just gives you a sense of the conception, you know, and the degree of education that journalists in general have about the hacking community.
You know, there's a very low amount of education on this, and I'm told by other people that on most stories that the media does, they know virtually nothing about the stories that they're covering, and that's sad. It's also quite dangerous. What has happened in the hacker world, the hackers do not trust the media, and for a very good reason, because they've been misrepresented so many times. To give an example of the most recent case, one of the hackers that was raided in New York City fairly recently, within the last couple of months, was said to have accessed free telephone lines somehow. So the New York Post took that to mean that he actually went underground through manhole covers and was able to access the lines that were underneath there, and that's exactly what they printed in their pages.
Ridiculous.
And, you know, not to pick on the Post, although I do like doing that, it's something that happens in media of all kinds, radio, TV, newspapers, magazines. So it's unhealthy, and it's good to see somebody come along that that seems to be learning something. I've noticed that with your articles. The last one, the front page article about hackers in the Village Voice, really seemed to capture the spirit of what it's all about. Someone reading that article is not going to sit back and say, well, these hackers are, you know, should be locked up and they're a threat to mankind. They're going to invade my personal life, you know, and all the garbage you get when you read the normal newspapers, you know?
Mm-hmm. Also, I tried to give, you know, a sort of flavor of just the whole cultural milieu, which a lot of people have a very stereotyped sense of, you know, well, white, middle class, nerdy, you know, socially inept kids, right? And, you know, here in New York, in any case, the hacker world is multiracial. It crosses class lines. And just from, you know, as a lot of people could tell from looking at the picture on the cover of The Voice, these are not nerdy-looking kids. In fact, we got a number of, you know, calls or a number of reactions from people saying, well, why didn't you use real hackers? Why did you use models, you know?
That's really something. The hackers showed up, though, with masks on.
Yeah. Well, that was because our lawyers wouldn't let them appear on the cover with their, you know, faces exposed. And, you know, some of them also had quite legitimate...
Now, yeah, I suppose a lot of people would say at this point, well, you know, if hackers believe that what they are doing is not wrong, why all the fear? Why do they protect their identities and cover up their faces? And I think perhaps this might be a good lead-in to the story of Craig Nydorf. Actually, by definition, Craig is not even a hacker. He is a publisher of material that is of interest to hackers and anybody that's interested in how telephone systems and computer systems work. The ordeal that he has been through over the past several months is enough to shock just about anyone, I think, and to pretty dramatically illustrate the need for protection from those eyes that are always out there watching, eyes and ears. It's a frightening situation, folks. And with that, let me give the floor to Craig. Craig, if you could tell us when it all began. First of all, give us some background as to what FRAC was. That was the magazine that you worked on.
Well, I'll go into that in a second. I'd like to take a moment to focus what you were saying about the anonymity ideal about the hackers with the, you know, not wanting to be seen, wearing masks and that kind of thing.
Right.
Ironically, if I had taken that attitude, it's possible this wouldn't have happened. It's because I was so public that they were, you know, able to come after me so quickly.
You made absolutely no attempt to hide your identity, did you?
Well, not really. We, FRAC, an electronic publication, it's been compared to, say, being a wire service as opposed to a magazine in some ways, just so people get a better idea of how it works. Every copy of the magazine that was sent over this wire service carried with it the network address that it was sent from. This network address, translated at the University of Missouri, where I a student, came out as my student number, which is unique to just to me, like a Social Security number might be.
So basically somebody would call a particular computer system, they would receive mail from a certain location in the country, and that would be your identification code, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and it could only be received by computer. It was not mailed through the U.S. mail.
That's correct.
Okay, now, what kind of information was in that magazine? Was it...
At different times, there was often news, current events relating to the hacker community, such as announcements of conventions or maybe stories about them, raids of hackers, you know, that got in some sort of trouble. Oftentimes we covered stories about litigation involving some of the telephone companies or concerning new firms or divestitures and that sort of thing.
Now, did you ever print material that you thought was, you know, might get you into trouble, illegal things, codes, passwords, that kind of thing?
No, we always made it our policy never to print any kind of legitimate codes or passwords, you know, in FRAC. Sometimes articles were sent that contained them. We never knew if they really worked or not since we never tried them, but we just decided to take the safe way out and just sort of remove the material if it was ever received.
So as you were putting out this magazine, when did the magazine begin coming out?
Well, it started in, the exact date of the first issue, of the release of the first issue, was November 17th in 1985.
Now, in all that time, as you were doing this, did you ever think that the government would try to shut you down?
Sometimes, you know, just because perhaps they wouldn't like what we had to say. But as time went on and we never really heard any kind of complaints, it just sort of didn't become a legitimate fear anymore.
So now the events of this year, the government tried to convict you based upon something that you published. They tried and they failed quite miserably, I might add, which we'll get into in a moment. But despite that, FRAC is no more. Now, perhaps you could embellish upon that a little bit and tell us how they lost the case, but how they also won by accomplishing what it was they set out to do.
Well, in response to your earlier question about when the events started taking place, it was January the 18th of this current year, 1990. I received a visit originally from a representative of the University of Missouri who served me with some papers concerning a subpoena that had been made on my files. Not just my files from the university mainframe, but for some reason all of my academic files, grade transcripts and things of that nature. With him, and waiting just a couple floors below, was two agents from the United States Secret Service and a representative from Southwestern Bell Security. And that's basically when it started. I don't think they really knew what they were after exactly. But they just took anything I had to say and just found ways to sort of twist it around.
Now, what were your feelings at that point when you realized they were there looking for something? Did you feel like things were going to work out? Did you feel it was the end of the world? What?
Well, I sort of had one of those sinking feelings, you know, in your belly, going down your throat. I don't think it's fun to be confronted by an authority figure in general, because, you know, it usually means that something's gone wrong or someone has found some sort of displeasement of some kind. Originally, though, the impression that they gave me was that I was not in any kind of trouble at all, that they were just kind of conducting some background information. So I was very open and honest with them. You know, I didn't have anything to hide, and so I told them everything they wanted to know. It helped me and it hurt me. It hurt me because they interpreted what I said in a perspective that they wanted to rather than the perspective it was intended. But at the same time, when it came out later at trial that I, you know, all the information, you know, that I was open and honest about it, that was is very good.
What eventually happened in the trial? Perhaps you want to detail that at this point.
Well, officially, the trial went on for, well, the first day of the trial was actually just jury selection, followed by 3 days of testimony, and on the fifth day, the charges were officially dropped by the United States Attorney's Office in Chicago.
Now, this all centered upon the infamous 911 document. What was that document?
Well, essentially, it was a text file, roughly 11 pages in length, sort of an overview of some of the administrative and I guess, bureaucratic functions of the responsibilities of each of the different offices within the telephone company. For instance, it might say that this department will handle installation of 911 service, but, you know, this other department will handle complaints and repair, and, you know, this department over here will handle maybe upgrades. It just was real general. It had virtually no computer information whatsoever. It was just sort of a...
It was real boring, too, wasn't it?
Pardon?
It was real boring as well, from what I recall.
Yeah, it was kind of boring.
Uh-huh. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, the government valued this this document based upon what it was told by Bell South, valued it at over $79,000.
Well, yeah, Bell South experts, and experts is in quotes, obviously, valued the information or valued the document that appeared in FRAC at roughly, well, the exact figure they gave was $79,449.
Now, what did the document actually turn out to be available for?
Well, a superior document containing not just the information found in the FRAC article, but even more information, is available from a catalog that's published by Bellcor, which is sort of the think tank of all the regional Bell operating companies. There's an 800 number that you can call to get this catalog and to order documents. And this particular one retails for
$13. $13, so that's a bit of a discount there, eh?
It's a considerable discount.
Now,
you have to give them a little bit of credit, though, in that they did revalue the document before trial to $23,900.
So they shaved about $50,000 off.
That's right.
But while we can laugh at this and say it's absurd, you've paid quite a price for finding out that that document was, in fact, virtually worthless. You want to detail?
Anyone, I think, that ever took a look at it could see that it was a worthless document.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, as soon as I saw the document, which was shortly after... Actually, I saw it last year when it was originally published, but I took a close look at it after all this started happening. And in my wildest imagination, I could not imagine how somebody could think that was worth something, or it contained trade secrets, or was going to harm the company in any way by getting out. It was literally, you know, how 911 systems work, and very, very fuzzy details at that. Something that I think everybody has a right to know, and nothing proprietary, at least nothing I could see. It seems that that has been confirmed, finally. They admit, yes, there is nothing really sensitive here. It's available to the public, and it's not expensive at all, and it's you know, there's nothing secret in here. Yet, you had to go through a trial to find this out. Now, why? How come it worked out this way?
I'm not sure. I think a lot of people just didn't know what they were doing to a certain extent. I'm not going to cast blame here. In fact, it's a topic I kind of want to stay away from right now, as there's some pending litigation concerning this,
uh-huh,
you know, with relation to the telephone companies.
What exactly have you had to go through?
Well, it's not easy when, you know, the Secret Service appears on your doorstep. And like I said, on January the 18th, I was a little worried, but I still, at the time, thought everything was going to be okay. They left me with the impression that, you know, I cooperated, and it'll be putting in a good word for me, that I wasn't really in trouble. They just were trying to gather information on the person who had sent me the document. A federal search warrant was issued for my room. I was living in a fraternity house, and so I only occupied, you know, one room in the house. So they had a search warrant for that room, and they generally have these descriptions of what they're looking for pretty broad. And so I took a look at that, and I feared that everything I owned was about to leave. I didn't sleep for probably 3 weeks after that. I mean, maybe I'd lay unconscious for 2 hours or something, but, you know, you don't really sleep. It was a lot of anxiety. It was very rough on my parents. They just couldn't believe this was happening. I couldn't believe it was happening. Lots of my friends said to me that I'm just not the type of guy that something like this happens to. and maybe that was some of the irony of the situation. My sister, in turn, kind of trying to ignore it completely. She just clearly couldn't, you know, handle what was going on to a much greater extent, and I couldn't discuss it in front of her or around her at all because it would just drive her kind of crazy, I guess.
Well, one thing I've learned dealing with many cases like this, of course, yours is probably the most extreme, people react very strangely when the government starts moving against them. And when you have a room full of Secret Service agents suddenly burst through your door and start searching for anything computer-related, a lot of people act very strangely. You say your sister acted strangely. I imagine quite a few of your friends probably acted strangely, too.
That's true. I had some people, well, broke off ties with me altogether, prompted by, you know, other reasons to be certain. One of the people I was kind of involved with was my best friend, and is also co-publisher of the magazine. We had spoken immediately after this had started happening, but soon after that, both our attorneys recommended that we cease all communications, which was pretty rough to do. We'd been roommates, prior to that, and best friends since, I'd say, the fourth grade.
Now, and you say that you were co-publishers, yet no charges were filed against him, and
well,
all the charges were filed against you.
There's some reasons for that, and some of which I can't go into exactly.
Uh-huh.
But no charges were filed against him at the time. I believe that they were using me sort of as a test. If the government, prosecutor in this case did promise that, and he used, when he gets me convicted, that my co-publisher would have been indicted within, the first time the grand jury convened after that date. So it's not like they weren't attempting to go after him. I think they were just biding their time.
Mm-hmm. So the trial began this summer in July.
Well, I'm moving up to that point.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
This all started taking place. The 18th of January was sort of 4 days into the school semester. I had just come off of a semester in the fall where I'd finally, started doing very well academically. I mean, I was an okay student, but I finally pulled some really decent grades. And then I was looking to make another really good semester out of it, but I was turned around by this. I had to drop almost all of my classes because of this. I was missing too much class. I couldn't handle it. I couldn't concentrate on anything because my mind was always, wrestling with what was going to happen to me because of the government raids, which ultimately is causing me to stay in school an extra semester here. But that's getting something else later. But then I was always having to leave town on the weekends. The fraternity I was living in, the trustees there, concerned partially about bad publicity and so forth, convened to, there was some talk about having me fully expelled from the fraternity just because I was accused of a crime. And what ultimately happened with that is I was suspended. I was allowed to live into the house, but I was not exactly a full member. I wasn't supposed to actually attend any functions at the time. They did this, they say, to protect themselves. But the bottom line is, when someone gets indicted, 95% of the time, yeah, that's a statistic that just sort of goes around, 95% of the time they are convicted. And because of that, people look at you, and when they see you're on the news, when they see you are indicted, to them, you are as good as convicted. And
uh-huh.
That's just the way things go.
And I guess in some cases, even after you're found innocent, you're still thought of as guilty. Is that 95% figure, is that all indictments or just federal indictments?
I'm not sure. I would imagine it's federal.
Uh-huh.
Indictments. The first attorney I went to in St. Louis, we kind of started to set up a meeting, with the attorney's office, the U.S. attorney's office in Chicago, where I would go up and just, another question and answer session to kind of hopefully explain what was going on so they'd see that it was very harmless and, nothing illegal was taking place. Unknown to me, the government had already been to the grand jury and presented all the information they had to get me indicted, including testimony that the 911 document was a program that could control 911, and that, of course, the fictitious value of almost $80,000.
And that's, yeah, you just touched upon a very important aspect to all of this. When this case first broke, it was being reported by all the media sources as a program that you were accused of publishing, a program that could control the 911 switches and all that kind of thing. And when in actuality, it was an 11-page document. How do you think things can get so distorted?
Well, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and say that they didn't do it on purpose. Perhaps it was just a miscommunication between, you know, the attorney's office and perhaps some of the media, or between the reporter and his editor.
Well, we have a journalist here, Julian DeBell from The Voice. How do you think such a thing happened?
Well, it happened because the press release, as I understand it, the press release that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago published at the time of the announcement of the indictment simply said that it was a program. I mean, it was right in there, and it even said so getting into the indictment. But once, if you read it carefully, you know, you could tell that what they were talking about was a document. But journalists, as I said, you know, are already pretty hazy about the whole world of computers, and, you know, and they're pressed for time, and, you know, they're not going to sit around analyzing an indictment, you know, to the detriment of Craig.
You know, something interesting about I guess any government press release concerning an indictment, there's a paragraph that follows these things at the bottom that talks about how a person is innocent until proven guilty, and, you know, how just because they're indicted does not say anything about them. And it's issued with all the press releases that go to the different news publications, but you never see them print that part.
And you also never see them print in big headlines when somebody is found innocent.
Right.
Well, there's, you know, one exception I saw to this, as far as, you know, front page headlines go, was the Houston Chronicle. They're the only paper I know that, you know, had a front page article talking about, you know, when the charges were dropped.
Uh-huh. That's something worth noting. The Houston Chronicle?
Right. The reporter down there, his name is Joe Abernathy.
Uh-huh.
Now, you know, there was also a very good article in The Voice.
Written by yours truly.
That's right. Thank you.
Well, you know, there are several magazines, newspapers that do have reputable journalists, and in the hacker world, we try to keep in touch with those people and not talk to the people that are just going to get the story wrong all the time, and I don't think that's a bad attitude to have. I think it's a very realistic one.
And I was talking about what took place throughout the semester. I was always traveling, you know, to whether it be Chicago or St. Louis. So not always just for lawyer meetings, but sometimes just because I couldn't handle just being down there, you know, at school. You know, I just had to get away, maybe just go home and, you know, kind of just make sure my mom was okay or something like that.
Now, you were facing a pretty lengthy time in jail, right?
Well, at the time, now, the first indictment, in a sense, I guess I was indicted twice. There was a superseding indictment in June. But in the first indictment, the maximum time would have been something like 31 years. And there was also like a fine of some $122,000 associated with that.
That's for publishing a newsletter in this country.
That's right.
That's incredible.
Now, right at the...
And how old are you, Craig?
Well, right now I'm 21.
You're 20, so you were 20 at the time of this?
Well, I was 19 when I published the article.
Uh-huh.
20 when I was indicted.
Well, now, what kind of message does this send to you as somebody, an aspiring journalist, to have such a harsh reaction from the government on something you publish?
Well, it sends a message, all right. I'm not sure, you know, what it is or what... It's very much politics, I think.
Well, I mean, do you feel embittered by all this?
Well, it depends towards whom. See, one of the things that kind of came out at the end of the trial was that, you know, the man at the top actually, you know, gave the word to, you know, dismiss the case. And so I, you know, for a long time I just felt that the entire the U.S. Attorney's Office, you know, was sort of a corrupt organization because of this. But as I learned, it really is not a bad office. It's just sometimes some people, you know, get the message wrong. And when it came time to do the honorable thing, that's what they did.
So you're saying basically the system works?
No, I don't think this. I'd say the system works. If the system worked, this wouldn't have happened in the first place.
Uh-huh.
Right at the beginning of May, and just prior to the first day of finals week at college, I received a call from the assistant vice chancellor here at the University of Missouri. And the lady there wanted to speak to me about disciplinary action against me. You know, remember, this all started taking place as far back as January. Now, the whole semester had passed by,
mm-hmm.
and the first day of finals week, they want to start laying something like this on me, which is sort of gets... I refused to meet with her at the time, because I was not going to issue any kind of public statement or anything to that effect.
So you had to deal with your frat house wanting to kick you out, with the school wanting to do some kind of disciplinary action against you right before finals. You had to deal with the U.S. government breathing down your neck. You had to deal with friends who were reacting in weird ways, relatives reacting in strange ways, and plus your own inner self. What gave you strength throughout all this? I mean, I don't think I could do that.
I don't know. Sometimes I would get... I didn't have access to computers, really. I mean, I just stopped using a modem altogether. You know, I had a computer to use for, you know, typing up an essay or a term paper or something like that. But sometimes people would send me printouts of discussions being taken place on bulletin boards or in certain magazines, like with the new, what's called the Computer Underground Digest, that's distributed from Northern Illinois University.
And that's also an electronic publication, as yours was.
Right. That one's run by Professor Jim Thomas and Gordon Meyer.
Uh-huh. And if there's one good thing to come out of all this, it's the creation of that newsletter, because it's important to get the message out, a voice of sanity in all this craziness. You know, it's such a precious thing to have.
Yeah, when I started seeing people's reactions, you know, and who was kind of there for me, and some of the talk going on, it helped. It helped a lot just to know that there were some people that, you know, could see past all of the lies. You know, what really bothered me the most was some of the newspaper articles that claimed that there were all these millions of lives in jeopardy because of this. There were actually people that were very upset with me after reading that, because, you know, they believed it.
So to illustrate that, you published a document explaining how the 911 telephone system works. And that gets translated into you distributing a program that can actually be used to disrupt the 911 system itself. That's how distorted it all got.
But I think the way it came across to a lot of people was that I personally almost did this.
Oh, that you personally logged in and okay, take it one step further then.
Yeah.
In actuality, though, I believe you never even called any of these systems yourself. You were a publisher.
I didn't even have a number to call.
Uh-huh.
Like, not that I would have called, but... That's right from the onset. See, and the article never gives any phone numbers. And that was pretty much what happened right there in May. The original court date, of course, was scheduled for April 16th, I guess. And that was postponed mainly so I could finish the semester in school, but also largely because we need more time to prepare. We pulled together some motions to be filed, three very important motions to dismiss the charges, and those were filed at the end of April, and the answer to those was given right towards the end of May, towards the beginning of June, and in one instance, some charges weren't dismissed because the prosecution decided that our motion was correct and dropped them themselves when they went ahead and superseded the indictment in June. You see, what they did with that is that they, just before the new court date, which was going to take place in June, they came up with a new indictment alleging a lot more wire fraud charges, but dropping charges of concerning the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act of 1986. It was just, something else to stick us with.
So basically you were re-indicted. What was the maximum penalty for your new indictment?
Well, looking at, I don't know what, you know, how it's really tallied, because, you know, I wasn't paying too much attention to that. Having it happen to me, I just couldn't really face that possibility. But the interstate transportation of stolen property counts, there were three of them, have a maximum penalty of 10 years each. The wire fraud counts have a maximum penalty of 7 years each, or, no, excuse me, 5 years each. There was an 11-count indictment where 10 of the counts focused on me, and if you add up 7 wire frauds and 10 stolen property counts, that comes out to be 65 years. I don't even know what the fine would have been.
That's unbelievable. We're speaking with Craig Neidorf, college student who published a newsletter and was almost put in jail for publishing that newsletter. Quite a shocking story, a story of hell, really, starting in January. Actually, it has not yet ended because the ordeal is still there with expenses and aftershocks and all that kind of thing. It's the kind of thing you just don't think can happen here, but it does. It happens here, and it happens to people that, as Craig said, it's not supposed to happen to people like me. It's got me speechless. That's what it is. It's something that we should all be concerned with and all be educated about, and that's why we're talking about this tonight on the Fifth Corner. My name is Emmanuel Goldstein. You're listening to WBAI, and we have to, at this point, ask for your help to keep this radio station going, to keep news like this coming your way. Actually, we don't want to keep news like this coming your way, but if you don't hear about it here, you're not going to hear about it anywhere else. If you're sitting there at home or in your car or wherever you have got a radio turned on, ask yourself this question. Have you heard this story before? Have you heard of what Craig Neidorf has gone through, of the real threat of putting out a newsletter in this country, and how you can pay for it in many, many ways? If it's something that you have not heard before, ask yourself, would you ever have heard this story if WBAI were not here? With that in mind, please give us a call at this point and show your support. And what we are willing to do is throw in a year's subscription of 2600 Magazine, the Hacker Quarterly, where you can learn all the details about this and many other hacker stories, as well as when there's time, stories on hacking itself, how hacking really works, how computer systems are penetrated, how the phone company is either ripping people off or is open to incursions themselves. 279-3400, area code 212. A pledge of $55 will get you 1 year of 2600 Magazine, the Hacker Quarterly. We do need to see those phones start ringing, and then we can go back to Craig Neidorf and Julian DeBell from the Village Voice. Now, we're going to cut over to the tally room, and is our tally coordinator there? I guess there's a conversation going on in there. Okay. Well, while that's happening, let's get those phones ringing. There are no callers on the line. 279-3400 is our phone number. We need to see at least two more calls come in before the hour strikes, and then we can go back to this shocking tale. And I don't mean to sound sensationalist by saying shocking tale, but damn it, this is a shocking tale. This is not the kind of thing that's supposed to be happening in this country. There's supposed to be freedom of speech. There's supposed to be the freedom to say and to publish and to do what you want to say. There was no illegal information posted or spread about here. There was no fraudulent goings-on. Yet, you see the results here. We see someone that has almost had to drop out of school, someone who has been forced to curtail his publication, someone who has a massive, massive legal expense to deal with. And if you're feeling really generous tonight, folks, we'll be giving out the address for the Legal Defense Fund in just a few minutes, too. But we do need to see those phones start ringing, 279-3400. Show your support for WBAI. Keep the news as it happens coming to you, because as I said before, you are not going to hear this anyplace else, and if you don't hear it anyplace else, you're not going to know about it, and if you don't know about it, it will keep happening, and it will get worse. And eventually, one day, you will be affected by it. Now, you know, I don't mean to over-dramatize this and say if you don't support WBAI, we're going to fall into a totalitarian state. Now, that's not quite what's going to happen, but we may fall into an ignorant state. And ignorance is a very good friend of totalitarianism, believe me. 279-3400, area code 212. We do need to see those calls start coming in. For a pledge of $45, you'll be a regular member of WBAI. You can proudly walk down the street and say you're a regular member of WBAI, and people will step aside for you, I'm sure. For $55, only $10 more, you can get a full year of 2600 magazine mailed straight to your house or your P.O. box or your grandmother's house or anywhere you want. You'll learn all about these things as they happen, which is a lot sooner than most people will. I mean, imagine how many people out there don't even know, don't have a clue as to what's going on in the hacker world. You've probably at some point said to yourself, what does computer hacking have to do with me? Well, if you're listening tonight, listening to the story of Craig Nydorf and how his magazine was shut down, you can see that it can relate to many, many other ways of life. You know, maybe it's a hacking magazine today. Maybe it's a cultural magazine tomorrow, you know, or somebody doesn't like the way certain art is presented, or somebody doesn't like a certain political ideology. You know, it's all connected. And it doesn't even have to be, you know, a plot of some sort. It doesn't have to be somebody saying, okay, we've got the hackers. Now we're going to, you know, we're going to get the gays and lesbians. Now we're going to get the minority groups of whatever choice we feel like doing. You know, there doesn't have to be a plot, but it just sort of happens, you know. You attack one group, there's one less group, then you attack the next group. It just happens. It's sort of the public way of looking at things, you know. So we have to be educated. We have to know what's happening. We have to remain alert. We have to spread the word. You know, you should tell somebody what you heard tonight on the radio, because odds are there's a lot of people out there that did not hear this. So you can help out by talking to other people, by educating them, by spreading the word. But you can help us out now, most immediately, by calling 212-279-3400. I'm going to attempt to speak to Tally again. Tally, are you there? I guess not. Okay, well, they don't have the speaker up. That's why they can't hear me. But it sounds like they're busy down there. It sounds like they're talking to people. Tell you what, one more call comes in. If I see one more pledge come in, we'll go back to Craig and Julian, and we'll be continuing with this story because there's a lot more to talk about. Remember, 212-279-3400 for a pledge of $55. You will get thrown in on top of everything else a copy or a full year of 2600 Magazine, the Hacker Quarterly. And in addition to that, of course, you'll be getting the WBAI folio every month, so you know what is on the air. That's right, we're the only radio station around that actually has programs that change from month to month. So the folio is a very necessary tool. 212-279-3400. Thanks to all those of you who called in, and if you're thinking about calling, please do, because it's one sure way you can make a difference. And hopefully Craig and Julian are still here. You guys still there?
I am.
Okay, sorry to put you on hold like that. We do want to continue with the story. Before we go back to Craig, Julian, any perspective on what you've heard so far? Has this jived with what you understood the story to be?
Absolutely, and you know, Craig has really gone through a nightmare, and you know, a lot of scary issues have come up, especially about the status of the press in a computerized society. You know, this is how the First Amendment gets eroded. I mean, this is we have a whole history of this in this century. As new technologies of communication come along that are basically analogous with the press that existed at the time of the Constitution, people willfully or not refuse to see the analogy between the new technologies and the press, and use that as an excuse to rope off areas of communication from the protection of the First Amendment. And that's clearly what's happening in the case of FRAC. But it's also important to note that there's always, you know, there's always an excuse that they're giving. And here, the action against FRAC and Craig was part of a larger campaign that really heated up earlier in the year against the hacking community at large. There were a number of raids that went on throughout the spring on hackers, and particularly on the whole notion of a hacking culture, which seems to really offend a lot of these law enforcement people. You know, Gail Thackeray, an attorney out in Arizona who's really active about prosecuting hackers. I just read a quote from her recently, and she was just offended at the thought that a group of quote-unquote criminals could have conventions and their own publications. You know, this is an outrage, and this is the first thing that has to go, because, you know, hackers represent a threat to our national security, to commerce, et cetera, and it's just, you know, an outrage that they can, you know, have their own culture and their own, you know, sense of community. And so this is what they targeted. They targeted FRAC, and they targeted another organization. I don't know if that's even the term for it, the Legion of Doom. I mean, one thing that also came along with that original press release about Craig's indictment was, you know, the statement that, yes, he associated with members of the Legion of Doom, which is, I don't know if I'm the best person to explain what that is here, but it's, you know, it's sort of an honorary society of hackers, very loosely organized, and very much not about, you know, conspiracy and concerted action. And the media just ate it up, and the prosecutors did too. And every time there was an indictment of hackers, they made a big point of saying that, you know, they were members of, or they associated with members of, the Legion of Doom, a closely knit group of hackers, you know, who conducted a number of activities in various states, blah, blah, blah.
But you see, Julian, the media wants a story, and the prosecution wants a victory, you know. And when you're able to successfully say computer hacker equals criminal, and then you refer to them as criminals, it makes it so much more easy. You know, you can say, well, we have to lock these criminals up, and it's, you know, it's just like the Soviet counterpart where you call everyone under 15 a hooligan, you know, or you know, you just categorize people as terrorists or drug dealers or criminals of some sort. It makes it so much more simple.
You know, Julian, along with the press release and actually comments in my indictment with reference to the Legion, it was interesting to note that while the indictment alleged that the indictment stated this as a definition of what the Legion was, it listed a different number of activities inherently illegal that they, you know, had done. Yet at the time of that indictment, I can't recall a single one of their single member of that organization that had been convicted of any of those offenses. You know, it was really just what they suspected they might have done.
And again, that does not show up in the headlines when somebody doesn't get charged with a crime. When they are suspected of being part of a crime, well, that makes the front pages. Craig, at this point, before you continue with your story, I'd like you to answer two questions. Number one, how much has all of this cost you? And number two, how can people help?
Well, are you speaking financially?
Financially, yeah. I don't know about emotionally what we can do there.
Well, there's even more beyond than that, but. Well, financially, it's actually kind of hard to say with any certainty. I still haven't seen the final legal bill as of yet. I'm told that it roughly comes out to be, you know, in the realm of $100,000. That that's not including fees paid to the first attorneys that we hired in St. Louis, which was probably another additional $8,000 went to them. I'm still waiting to see the final breakdown. I'm told it was actually much higher than that, but the firm that is Ken Muchin and Zavis in Chicago had found different ways to cut certain parts out of the bill to other things or reduce certain, you know, they just clipped the sum off, just, I guess, in the spirit of good business. But for those, you know, who are interested and, you know, I don't know, but if you're interested, stuff can't, well, I hate to say money, but that's what it kind of boils down to.
That's what everything seems to boil down to, unfortunately.
Yeah, contributions are, you know, greatly accepted. You could send them to, in care of Sheldon Zenner, Z-E-N-N-E-R, and he's with the firm of Katten, K-A-T-T-E-N, Muchin, M-U-C-H-I-N, and Zavis, Z-A-V-I-S. They're located at 525 West Monroe Street, Suite 1600 in Chicago, Illinois, 60606. If you do decide to send anything in, you should include some sort of note on where it's supposed to be allocated to, because otherwise it's the general fund.
Uh-huh.
Probably something on the memo section of the check would be a good idea.
Uh-huh. Now, we've mentioned before, this has cut tremendously into your college fund, and
I'd say it's cut. There's nothing left.
There's nothing left. And the ironic thing is that you weren't convicted. You know, you won for all intents and purposes. You won the case, but you've been devastated financially, emotionally. Your academic future has been stomped upon quite a bit. So if people out there feel inclined to help, I'm sure it would do something emotionally for you. So any contribution, however large or small, will definitely have an effect. And
this case was indicative of the true fact, the unfortunate fact, that today's legal system boils down to how much justice can you afford.
Yeah, you could have stopped at any time with a plea bargain, right? But you didn't do that. Why?
Well, an official plea bargain wasn't really offered up until sometime during the middle of the trial. The government prosecutors clearly believed that they had this one in the bag. In fact, it's my understanding that they really just could not understand why I didn't plead guilty, you know, why I wanted to go through with the trial.
Well, most people when faced with such a situation would plead guilty, right, to avoid what you went through.
It depends. I know that...
I know of hackers that have pleaded guilty to things that they didn't do just so that they didn't have to go through what you went through.
I had too much on the line for this. I'm hoping to enter law school. I was hoping for next year, but that's not going to be possible now. Any kind of conviction just wouldn't be good for that, let alone a felony conviction would be devastating. It would be no possibility of entering any law school. But, hello?
I see there's somebody's call waiting, or we're going to get another emergency interrupt.
I guess that's my call waiting.
Ah, okay.
Even a misdemeanor conviction is going to make them, you know, look twice and think about it before they admit you into their school. There was more than that. See, I didn't deny having received these files, having sent them, you know, put them in the newsletter. It wasn't about that. This case was not a whodunit. This case was about what, you know, the activity that took place, was that illegal? And, you know, I said it wasn't, and that's what this is about.
The activity being publishing the article.
That's correct.
Now, we're at the stage where you're about to go to trial. Do you want to fill us in on just how that worked out?
Right before the second indictment.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Right before the superseding indictment of June, in June 1990. See, it's around this time, well, a little before that, at the end of April, was a Newsweek article. It talks about Steve Jackson Games, that's the company, the book publishing company in Texas.
To clarify what that means, Steve Jackson Games publishes various well, various kinds of games and books and things like that. Now, they were implicated by the Secret Service because supposedly one of their employees was a hacker. So that was enough to have their entire offices raided, their computers taken, and the company nearly driven out of business.
Manuel, actually, on a side note to that,
yeah,
this employee hacker was one of the subscribers to the newsletter.
One of the subscribers to your newsletter.
Right. They were actually raided in some kind of connection to my case. I'm not sure, you know, the raid was spearheaded by the agents from Chicago, the same agents that conducted the search on me. The article is a good one. It starts showing that people's rights are being trampled upon. Unfortunately, it still included me on part of the as part of the people that deserve to be trampled.
How so?
It didn't name me, but it named me sort of anonymously as one of the four Legion members, although I wasn't ever a member of the Legion. I am indicted in a conspiracy to do something to 911.
So they still didn't get it right that you, in fact, published an article about 911 and that you hadn't invaded the system and were trying to overthrow it.
Right. Now, Newsweek later, I'll get to that in a moment, they later, you know, corrected themselves in the July 2nd issue. But in the meantime, on June 3rd, was probably the first positive article that was written about me. Well, it wasn't really about me exactly. In the New York Times, on the front page of the Sunday, June 3rd issue, was an article talking about, you know, the civil liberties of people like myself being trampled upon. And it starts talking about a hacker defense fund being put together by people like Mitch Kapoor, and who later formed an organization with a few others like John Barlow and Steve Wozniak that they refer called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. But this was the first good news we got. In the meantime, let's see, as we get closer to the trial, the July 2nd Newsweek article, which actually, of course, Newsweek comes out, you know, a week ahead of their date, this article really got the point across that I did nothing more than publish an article in a newsletter, very similar to what Terry Gross, he's an attorney with the firm of Rabinowitz, Bowden, Standard, Kritzky, and Lieberman. They defended Daniel Ellsberg in the very famous Pentagon Papers case. He basically said that what happened with me is virtually the same thing as with the New York Times printing the Pentagon Papers leaked to them by Daniel Ellsberg. Clearly something that had, you know, already been ruled upon by the Supreme Court as being legally protected activity. And so I think this was very positive. I mean, it made me feel good to see it. But as we got closer to the trial, you know, originally, you know, I just wanted to get to it and get it over with. But as we got closer, you get a little, you know, apprehensive, a little scared just about the true seriousness of what's about to happen. Because it's easy to try and ignore it, especially for someone like me who's, I guess, a pre-law student. You know, working with attorneys and just sort of seeing how the process goes, taking an academic standpoint on the whole thing. Roughly, I...